The following is an excerpt from the Science Magazine podcast. To hear the whole show, visit www.sciencemag.org and click on Science Podcast.
Now, David Graham, editor of Science's online daily news site, Science Now, is here with a wrap-up of some of the latest science news, including a story about grieving chimpanzees. How do scientists know that the chimps are grieving, Dave?
It's a good question, Robin, one that's actually been very hard to test. It's actually very hard to find examples of what we would consider grieving in animals, even animals that are very close to us, like chimpanzees. What scientists have seen in the wild thus far has indicated that most animals, at least from what they see, don't appear to grieve. For example, they cite if a hunter shoots a deer that's next to another deer, that deer just doesn't even seem to acknowledge that that other deer has been shot. There are some rare examples of what seems to be grieving. Some elephants, for example, seem to hold vigils over bodies of dead relatives. But researchers are really curious, you know, do our closest relatives, chimpanzees, exhibit grief in a way similar to we do?
So these are behavioral studies then?
These are behavioral studies. And again, it's really hard to observe this because, you know, it's hard to observe chimps in the wild. And even in zoos, if an animal dies, if a chimp dies in a chimp enclosure, most zoos remove the body. And so nobody's really been able to look at how these animals respond to the death of somebody that's close to them. So what was different about this new study is zookeepers actually allowed a chimpanzee who was in her 50s named Pansy, who was clearly in the last stages of life. She was very lethargic and obviously ill. They allowed her to remain in the enclosure with some of her relatives, including her 20-year-old daughter, who was named Rosie. And not only did they allow Pansy to stay with her relatives as she died, but even after she died, they left Pansy in the enclosure for a brief period of time. And they wanted to see what the reaction of the other chimps was. And what they noticed is that as Pansy got more and more ill, the other chimps in the enclosure began grooming her. They slept next to her. And in the 10 minutes before she died, they groomed her even more. And Rosie, her daughter, remained near her mother during the night. And even after the zookeepers removed Pansy's body, the other chimps in the cage remained unusually subdued for about a week. And, you know, researchers in the study point to all this evidence and say, you know, maybe this isn't exactly what a human would do when he or she was grieving, but this seems to be very strong evidence for grieving in chimpanzees.
Do researchers have examples of this that they've seen in the wild?
Yeah, in fact, there was another study published on the same day. Researchers observed some examples of what they say is chimp grief in chimps that were living in the forests of Guinea. And what happened here was there was an outbreak of a respiratory infection that had actually killed a few chimps, especially young chimps. And what the researchers saw was that there were two infants. There was a one-year-old and a two-year-old, and they died from this respiratory infection. But even after they died, their mothers continued to carry around their dead bodies for sometimes as long as 2 months. In one case, they groomed them, they swatted flies away from them, they even let other chimpanzees touch the bodies. And there's actually a video of this you can see on the site. And the researchers say this is another example of chimp grief. Maybe not, again, not exactly what you and I might do if we were grieving over a dead relative, but they say this may be sort of an analogous way that chimps deal with grief, maybe by, you know, continuing to hold on to a relative even after that relative has died.
Do researchers have ideas about why this might have developed evolutionarily?
Well, researchers aren't really speculating on that, at least in these studies. But what one of them does say, this is one of the researchers that observed the Pansy episode, was that this actually may be in a very important process. Grieving may be a very important process for chimps, just like it is for us. And he says if that's the case, then zoos actually might want to leave bodies in the enclosures, animal enclosures, rather than just removing them right away.
Okay. So what other stories have you brought with you this week?
Well, Rob, we mentioned briefly in that story how elephants deal with grief. This next story is about how elephants deal with bees. Turns out that elephants don't have a lot of predators in the wild. They've got humans and they've got lions, but they are terrified of bees. African bees are really nasty. They can swarm and sting elephants around their eyes, inside their trunks. They can even pierce the skin of young calves. So this is a really nasty thing for elephants. And what researchers think they've discovered is that elephants have a specific alarm call for bees, as sort of a warning that says, hey, there's bees, I'm being attacked by bees, everybody run away. And here's what it sounds like.
Wow, that's really low. Are there frequencies there that we're not hearing?
Well, that's the really hard part about studying elephant vocalizations is they make these deep rumbles, which are actually really hard for the human ear to pick up. And so there's a lot of probably subtlety in that call that you're not hearing. But what the researchers are saying is if they're correct, and this vocalization is actually specific for bees, it's actually very significant because it means that elephants have an alarm for a specific threat, which would be the first time that's ever been seen in elephants. And actually, it would be very unusual in the animal kingdom as a whole. And besides humans, there's very few examples of animals making specific calls for specific threats, because that would almost be a precursor to a type of vocabulary in non-human animals.
So how do the researchers test this hypothesis of theirs?
Well, they already had this alarm call recorded from previous studies, and the way they were able to get that was they recorded the elephants when they were confronted by these African bees, and they recorded this distinctive sound, which they call the bee rumble.
Let's hear it again.
So in the new study, they played this sound to the elephants, to 10 elephant families, and what they found was about 6 of the herds fled when they played that sound. But when they play this other sound, which is essentially the same vocalization you heard before, but the researchers removed some key acoustical features in it that they think were specific to the bee response, only a couple of the elephant families fled.
So what's the modified sound sound like?
Here it is.
And the original?
Here's the original.
They sound pretty much the same to me.
Right. Again, to our ears, you really have to be trained, and you probably need actually some pretty complicated sound analysis software to really pick out the differences here. But the important thing is the elephants notice the difference. And the researchers say that these subtle differences are almost like you and I making different vowel sounds to make different words. The elephants are making different acoustical features in their rumbles to signify different things. And in this case, they have this very specific acoustical feature, which seems to say, bees! Exclamation point.
So a digital manipulation to a sound file, still not the same as another more general alarm call made by the elephants themselves.
Right. And, you know, ideally what you would want is to really compare this call to a bunch of the other calls that elephants naturally make to really suss out the differences between these calls and whether they really do represent some sort of rudimentary elephant vocabulary.
Okay. So last one. What's this last story about?
Well, Rob, for one of the most massive animals on Earth, one of the most massive things in the entire universe, this last story is about dark matter and what it really looks like.
I thought you couldn't see it.
You can't see it. And that's because dark matter is this invisible matter, which researchers have speculated is responsible for basically holding the universe together. You know, based on what researchers know about the physics of the universe, stars should literally fly off into space and galaxies should dissipate very quickly because there's not enough mass to hold all this stuff together, at least not enough gravity from the matter that we know about to hold all this stuff together. And so in the 1970s, researchers started talking about something called dark matter, which would help explain how our universe holds together. And the idea is it's a bit like regular matter, but we can't see it. And they speculate that it accounts for about 23% of the stuff in the universe. But researchers have long wondered, what does it look like, or at least how is it distributed? But you can't tell how it's distributed in the universe if you can't see it.
So do you look for what you can see and then assume everything else is dark matter?
Something like that. What the researchers looked at is they said, you know, even though we can't see dark matter, something that big has to have an incredible gravitational effect on everything around it. And this is actually a theory called gravitational lensing, which was first proposed by Einstein, which basically says, you know, very massive objects will bend, literally bend beams of light because they're so massive.
So where there are big clumps of dark matter, then this gravitational lensing will happen around them.
Exactly. And what the researchers did in this new study was they used the Subaru telescope in Hawaii to look for this lensing effect in 18 galactic clusters. And what they found was that each of these clusters host these gigantic clumps of dark matter. And these clumps are actually are also known as halos. And by figuring out exactly where the halos were, they were actually able to see what the distribution of them was. And it turns out that these halos look a lot like footballs. And we're talking about American footballs here, not not soccer balls.
So like rugby balls then?
Like rugby balls. They're sort of tapered at the ends and larger in the middle. And you can actually see a picture of this on the site. And why that's important is because actually some of the models of the physics of the Big Bang predict this very type of distribution. And what's also really interesting about this finding is if all these clumps have basically the same shapes, no matter where they are, what it means is that even though dark matter has a very dramatic effect on all of the matter around it, it turns out this matter around it doesn't have a very strong effect on the dark matter. Because if it did, you would expect these halos to vary their shape galaxy by galaxy and exactly where they were. But these shapes really aren't changing, which means dark matter is exerting this enormous force on everything around it, but everything around it isn't really affecting dark matter that much.
So physicists might need a new force to account for that.
No, I mean, this what's being observed in the study actually fits very well with the models. But for the first time, we can say we're quote unquote seeing dark matter, even though we're not really. We're at least getting a better sense of how it's distributed in the universe.
Okay. Well, thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Rob.
So what other stories are you looking into for Science Now or on the policy blog, Science Insider?
Well, Rob, for Science Now, we're looking into stories about a new catalyst that could help pull hydrogen out of water. And this is very important for people who are interested in using hydrogen as a clean fuel source. And also a story about speeding up the recovery of broken bones. And for Science Insider, the Science's policy blog, we've got a story about how Italy and Russia are teaming together to create a new reactor. And also a story about what's going on with the barcode of life. And this is this effort to essentially establish a genetic barcode for every single species on Earth. So be sure to check out all of these stories on the site.
David Grimm is the editor of Science Now, the online daily news site of science. You can check out the latest science news, plus all the stories from the science policy blog, Science Insider, at news.sciencemag.org.